As I've probably already told you all, this first experiment, you could say, is about measurement. And that's because chemistry is a measurement-based science. If we're going to be doing other measurements in the lab, then we have to start somewhere, and that's talking about how do we do measurement, how do we handle numbers. So there's a couple of concepts I want to start out with that are mentioned at the beginning of your lab procedure. And these are the concepts of accuracy and precision, which in general conversation we often mix those two terms. But could anybody tell me what accuracy is versus what precision is? Anybody had these terms in a previous class? Yes. That's right. So accuracy is how close is your result to the result that you're supposed to get, which we'll refer to that as the accepted value. Precision, one of the meanings of precision, is that you're able to reproduce your results, that every time you measure, you get the same measurement. So often the way that this is represented is by using a set of targets. Imagine that you're playing a game of darts. And let's say that you're a pretty good aim, but let's say you're like me and have glasses and maybe need a little bit of change in your prescription. So every time you throw it, you tend to throw in the same place, but let's say that you're not quite on the center of the target. So this would be an example of something that's precise because you're able to repeat it over and over again, but it wouldn't be considered terribly accurate, especially if you got money bet on it, because you're not hitting the center of the target. So this would be the example of something that is precise, but not accurate. Now let's say that you throw over and over and again. And let's say you don't always end up in the same place. But if you were to average out all of your results, you end up right in the center of your target. So that means that no one measurement is the most precise, because you're not getting really reproducibility, but by doing it a bunch of times, you do end up with an accurate result. So this would represent something that is accurate, but not precise. Of course, in any kind of measurement, what we're hoping for is that you're going to be both, that you get the same value each time, and you get the same correct value each time. So again, if we were to hit right in the center of the target, this would represent something that is accurate and precise. So to write it out in word form, accuracy is how close is a measurement to the true or accepted value. And then precision, one of the definitions, is that it is how close are measurements to each other. Which, putting it a different way, means how reproducible are the results. But there's another form of precision as well, which if you're looking along in your lab manual, if you look on page 12, you see that there's a couple of rulers there that are at the top of the page. So to partly replicate it into the notes, let me draw this out. One of these rulers is marked off in centimeters. One of them is marked off in millimeters instead. And you might remember from our discussion in class that centimeters, there are 10 millimeters in each centimeter. The point is that if we wanted to measure the length of something, if I was measuring the length of this line on the centimeter scale, well, based on the scale, we could see that it's definitely longer than 2 centimeters, shorter than 3, but we'd have to guesstimate exactly how far it is in between. And so another form of precision is how many digits, how many valid digits does a piece of instrumentation or device give you in terms of the number that it gives you back. So we know that this is definitely 2, but that next digit we would have to guess. But as you can see on the millimeter scale, it's much clearer, even though this is not maybe the best drawn scale. According to this scale, we could see that it's right at about 2.4 centimeters. So that's another digit that we definitely know, and that's the point of what precision is. So in terms of instrumentation, or in terms of just the act of measurement itself, precision is how many significant digits does that instrumentation give? Significant means meaningful, you could say. How many significant digits does the instrumentation give? And that's one of the concepts that you're going to be examining in today's procedure, because you're supposed to be measuring water with a couple of different types of graduated cylinders. As you're going to see, one of the graduated cylinders has finer markings, similar to the way that we have the millimeter ruler here. One of the other graduated cylinders has fewer markings, which means we're not going to be able to get as precise information out of it. And so that's exactly the point of that exercise. Now, there is a way to measure precision, and it's something known as a standard deviation, which we're not actually going to cover in the lab today. But if you've had any kind of statistics before, if you might have had certain math classes, you might have talked about standard deviation before. So it's a formula that compares each piece of data to an average, and the formula gives back this number that represents how tightly packed are the data. One thing that we will talk about is a measure of accuracy, which is percent error. Now, there is a percent error formula that's on page 13 of your lab text, but I don't actually agree with the format of that equation, and I'll explain why in just a moment. But without looking at it, if you've had it in a past class, can anybody tell me what percent error is, what the formula for it is? Maybe you haven't had that concept before. So percent error is where we're going to compare the measurement that you take versus the accepted value. And in fact, that's the order that we're going to write this in. It's the measured value minus the accepted value. And that tells you how far off your value is. But it doesn't give a sense of scale. Let's suppose that you're supposed to get a number that's a million. Well, if you get 1,000,001, you're not that far off. Versus if you're supposed to get a number that's 10 and you get the number 11 instead. There's a lot more difference between the numbers 10 and 11 versus 1,000,001. So we take the measured value minus the accepted value, and we divide it by the accepted value to get that sense of scale. And then since we're supposed to be doing this in terms of percentage, then we're going to multiply by 100%. Now, the formula in your text has the top two numbers reversed. It has the true value minus the experimental value. The reason that I feel that's backwards is that instead of parentheses, the way it's written here in the lab text, I think they meant to put absolute signs, because that is one of the ways that this percent error formula is sometimes given, using an absolute value. But when you don't use the absolute value, then a positive percent error means automatically you've got a number that's too large, and a negative percent value means that you've got a number that's too small. So the different versions of the formula have to do with whether, as a concept, you think percent error is always a positive number, which is why you'd put the absolute signs, or whether the sign, the plus or minus of the number itself, tells you whether the number's too large or small. So I always prefer to do it with the plus or minus, and so in order to get the correct percent error, that means we put the measured value first. So when you calculate percent error later on in your experiment, don't use the version that's in your lab text. Use this reversed version instead. So, and I didn't write this down, but percent error is a measure of accuracy. Yes, question. Times 100, because percent has a value that goes between 0 and 100. If you just do the fraction by itself, it would be between 0 and 1, you could say, unless you had more than a 100% error, which that's possible if your number's way off. So to turn it into percentage, yes, we multiply by the number 100, and then we tack the percent sign onto it. Okay, so I mentioned the term average earlier, which I'm sure you must have heard of what an average is, but just in case, just wanted to write it out once. Sometimes in statistics, instead of calling it an average, we call it the mean. And there's different ways of representing that. One way is that if you have a set of data and you call each piece of data X, then to show that you have an average, you often put a bar atop that variable, and we would call that X bar. That means the average. Which, how would you calculate an average? Well, you add up all of your pieces of data, and then you divide by however many pieces of data that you have. So to write that out in equation form, often the way it's shown is something like this, where you say that you add the first piece of data, the second piece of data, the third, all the way up to the last piece of data. And often that's that number of pieces of data is represented by the letter N, standing for number. So if N is your number of pieces of data, once you add all the data together, then you just divide by that number that you have. So that is the average, which we will be coming up with an average when we do the experiment, because in order to really believe the values that we measure, we don't just measure once. Like, it might seem that you're doing a bit of busy work by repeating this procedure a few times, but we do that intentionally in real life in the lab to make sure that we have a precise result, that we have something that's consistent. So that's why you do need to know what the average is. So this is just a little introduction to the concepts of precision and accuracy. Anyone got any questions so far? All right. So you are using a couple different types of glassware. And so I wanted to talk for a minute about types of glassware. And I wanted to address some types of glassware we're not necessarily using today. But I have the sense that some of you haven't had much lab experience before. So why not you know a little bit about what gets used in a lab? So one type of glassware that you're using is one of the simplest, which is a beaker. So a beaker is just a cylindrical object that holds a certain amount of liquid. Very frequently, beakers may only have a very few number of volume markings on it. So a beaker is a piece of glassware that has very low precision, very low accuracy, meaning that you can't get a bunch of numbers off of your measurement because you'd have to guesstimate the volume. And the markings are not done terribly precisely because it's a less expensive piece of glassware. So beakers are usually used just to measure out an approximate volume. It's just something to hold a chemical reaction, not necessarily something you're trying to carefully measure with. a similar piece of glassware to that is what's called an Erlenmeyer flask. And it's similar to the beaker in that it's not going to have very many markings on it, and they're not going to be necessarily very careful markings. The reason for having an Erlenmeyer is because of its tapered shape and its wider base. It's somewhat less likely to fall over by accident. And if you're mixing something, it's less likely that something is going to splash out of it. One way that we can do this mixing, just to mention really quickly, is we don't necessarily have to use a stirrer. We have often in the labs what's known as a magnetic stirrer. So a magnetic stirrer, let me just show you one of them here. It's just something that has a flat base to it, and often that base is able to be heated as well. So this particular model, if you see the two knobs on it, one of the knobs is a temperature control, so you could heat up a mixture at the same time that you mix it. And then underneath the top of the plate here is a magnet. What you do then is you take a small Teflon-coated magnet and you can throw it into a beaker or an Erlenmeyer. And then the large magnet that's underneath the surface of the plate spins, causing that magnet inside the solution to spin as well. So it's super convenient because that means you don't have to sit there and mix it, or you don't have to come up with some complicated mechanical type of stirrer. You can just use magnets. No, because usually the surface of that magnet is coated in something that prevents it from reacting. So that is the purpose, though, of using an Erlenmeyer, if you're doing mixing like that, to keep it from splashing out. Now, you're not using any Erlenmeyers today. You are using beakers. You're also using what's known as a graduated cylinder, which, as the name says, it's a type of cylinder, and graduated means that it does have markings on it. And generally, it has a much larger number of markings, particularly depending on which kind of graduated cylinder you have. So graduated cylinders are used to get a better type of measurement. You would use that definitely over a beaker or an Erlenmeyer if you wanted to measure out some volume of liquid. It's still not the most precise, though. It's not the most accurate. Generally, the more you pay for a piece of glassware, the better that glassware is constructed. So graduated cylinders are relatively inexpensive, so they do an okay job of measurement. If you wanted to do much more careful measurement, there's two other pieces of glassware that, again, today we're not using, but they're so common that I would like you to go ahead and know what they are. One of them is known as a burette. So burette is a long, slender tube that generally has a bunch of markings on it, and those markings tend to be much more accurate and precise, meaning that you're able to get a lot of digits off of the volume measurement that you make, and the markings themselves are made much more carefully. So you use burettes when you're measuring specific volumes of liquid, and like I said, it gives you better results. The best type of piece of glassware to use, if you really wanted accuracy and precision, is something known as a volumetric flask. So these volumetric flasks often will only have one marking on it, but it's a marking that's been calibrated really carefully. For example, one common size of these flasks is 25 milliliters. But if you fill it up right to the line carefully, you're able to report not just the number 25, but 25.00, which is a different number than the number 25. So on a calculator, on a spreadsheet, if you type in 25.00, it might drop those zeros. But the whole point of precision, instrumental precision, the fact that you get digits that are meaningful, it means that, yes, we know to the tenths place and the hundredths place that this really is the number 25. So we don't drop those zeros, we carry them. And in fact, in just a little bit, we'll talk more about this concept of significant figures. So volumetric flasks, because of the way they're constructed, are usually precise enough that you get a lot more information out of them. So from left to right, the way that I've drawn this out, we've got increasing precision and accuracy for each of these types of glassware. Now, since we're talking about measuring liquid, I need to mention an effect that happens when you fill glass with different types of liquids. So some of you might already be familiar with the fact that if you filled up something like a graduated cylinder with water, the water won't just sit flat in that graduated cylinder. The top of the surface of water will actually be curved. Does anybody know what that curve is called? It is. So that's the meniscus. And that's a curve on the surface of the liquid. Due to the interaction of that liquid with the container. And I can't tell the full story at the moment because we're too early in the quarter, but let me try to give you a little explanation of why water ends up making this type of curve. We hopefully know by now, from talking in class, that water is a molecule that consists of two hydrogens attached to an oxygen. And it turns out that the connections between hydrogen and oxygen, the bonds between those atoms, are not evenly shared. Oxygen ends up being able to pull on electrons more strongly than hydrogen does. So there's a tug of war that's uneven here. Since electrons are negatively charged, if you have an atom that's pulling more electrons towards it than the other, that means the one that's pulling the electrons, the oxygen, is slightly negatively charged. So that sort of squirrely character, that's a lowercase Greek delta. And delta in science is usually used to represent change. In this case, it means a little bit. So this is a little bit negative on the oxygen. The hydrogens, because they're being pulled on, they end up being a little bit positive. And so water likes to stick to its own self because you have a positive on one molecule that's going to attract a negative on another. So that's one of these few fundamental things from physics that if you've never had physics, you need to know. That positive charges and negative charges tend to attract each other. Well, because of the structure of glass, glass also has these partial charges that can develop on its surface. And so water ends up being attracted to the glass, enough so that it will actually crawl up the sides of the glass because of that attraction. And that's exactly what's causing this meniscus. So the simplified way of saying it is what I've already written out here, that there's some kind of interaction going on. The interaction is due to charge, due to these positive and negative charges in water and on the surface of the glass. Now, in terms of practical, the reason that I'm describing what the meniscus is how do we handle measurement then? Do we measure at the top of this curve, or do we measure at the bottom? And the convention is that we measure right at the bottom of that curve. So when the curve is down, when the meniscus curves down, volume is measured at the bottom of the meniscus. And the reason I say when it curves down is that's not the only possibility. If this is water, as an example, on the left here, what if we had something like mercury instead? We won't be using mercury in class because it's toxic, but you might have seen old school thermometers that are mercury filled, or you might have seen, if not in real life, maybe a picture of a barometer, something that measures pressure. And in those containers that have mercury, the mercury will bubble up at the top instead of making a curve down. And again, it has to do with the interaction of mercury with itself versus the container. Mercury does not have these positive and negative charges like water does, and mercury ends up being more attracted to its own self than the glassware. And because it's more attractive to itself, it pulls in on itself, effectively away from the glassware, and so that's why you end up with a curve that points up instead. And so the convention here is that we measure volume at the top of the curve. So if the meniscus curves up, the volume is measured at the top of the curve. Now, there's one more issue with measuring volume. And again, this is why we have this lab today, so that we can get these concepts of measurement. So let's say that I've got a graduated cylinder, and let's say that it's filled with water, so I've got a meniscus that's going to curve down. The way that you need to observe this is to have your eye level right even with the bottom of that meniscus. So the symbol I drew, if you imagine that's an eyeball with the line up top here representing my eyebrows, so you know which way is up, you want to look directly along that curve so that you see the correct volume marking on the side. What if you were looking from up above instead? Well, as you look through the glassware, where that level seems to hit is going to be slightly off, which means you're not going to read quite the correct volume number because your eye is not in the correct viewpoint. This is an effect known as parallax. So instead of giving a definition for the term, because we're not going to use that term, let me focus on the concept here. If the eye level is not even with the meniscus, The wrong volume of liquid will be measured. Due to the incorrect viewpoint. Now, you don't want to hold the graduated cylinder up in the air because you want to make sure it's level. So that means you're going to have to bring your eye point down, which means you may need to sit down. I wouldn't get down on your knees, like get down towards the floor, because who knows what's been spilt on the floor before. So I mention that just because I've seen people do that trying to get to the right eye level. So you do need to get to the right eye level, but don't get down on the floor at all. Okay, I think I've talked everything about measuring volume that I need to talk about. Now I need to talk about measuring mass, because that's the other thing that you're going to be doing today. So briefly, we need to go into the balance room here so I can show you a little bit about balances. So let's all go on a miniature field trip. Come on in. It's okay, you can all come on in. I did shower this morning. All right. So the first thing you might notice about these balance have these windows on them. Tenth of a milligrams. And as you can see, if I blow on the surface of the balance here, you can see that the numbers change quite dramatically. So just the air currents caused by people moving around in the room can cause button. And then if you wanted to measure the mass of something, then you open up the window, put the object on there, and then wait a reasonable amount of time for the numbers to stop changing. If you have something solid like this set of keys, the numbers should stop, and then you write down every single digit that you see there. Now, some people tend to round the numbers off, but that's incorrect to do in this case, because the whole point of having these fancy balances is that we get good precision. So you want to write every digit down that you observe there. Now, there are some cases in which you don't want to wait for the numbers forever to stop changing. Can anybody think of an example of why you wouldn't want to wait forever for the numbers to stop changing? And let's say it's not because it's reacting, because, of course, that might cause the mass to change. But can you think of any other reason why you wouldn't wait? If you're measuring a gas and that gas might escape, or a liquid, right? If you have water and you spill water out on the bench top here, you know that even if it doesn't get cleaned up, you come back tomorrow, it's likely evaporated off. Well, that can happen quickly enough that even as you're measuring water, like what you're doing today, that number might keep changing. So at some point, you just have to say that the numbers are changing slowly enough that you're going to measure whatever's written down. And so that means that, yes, there's a little bit of imprecision that comes about when dealing with liquids. But unless you use sealed-off containers, there's no way to avoid that. The opposite is possible, too. You could have something where the numbers continually increase instead of decrease. And that might come about if you use something that's called, the term is hygroscopic, something that likes to absorb water. If you've ever bought certain types of food or electronic devices or medication, you might have had these little packets in it that say, do not eat. Well, those packets are exactly that. It's a type of material that's hygroscopic, which means it's trying to absorb water, so that means it keeps whatever it's put in dry. So if you were to put something like that on the balance and try to measure its mass, you're going to see its mass slowly creep up. So that's another case in which you might wait or not wait too long to write your numbers down. Now there's one more case that, in case you enter in a lab in the future, I want to mention, is what if you have a hot piece of glassware? Well, it's not because the hot object may damage the balance that you have to wait for it to cool down. There's another reason why you can't measure the mass well of something that's hot. Can anybody guess why in that case?
Air currents.
And why would that be?
Because the heat agitates the air in contact with the glass, which creates currents.
That's right. Hot air rises, and if you have an object that's hot enough, that can cause a little miniature air current to develop inside the chamber here. And like I said, these are sensitive enough that air currents can cause the numbers to change. So in that case, you'd have to wait for it to cool down closer to room temperature to not have what's known as this lift effect occur. So there's a little bit more involved in measurement than just putting something on a balance. Now, there are two ways of measuring out mass on a balance. The more convenient way, which you can do with a graduated cylinder, is exactly what I described earlier. You come up and hit the zero button, the tear button. You put your object on there. You wait for the mass to stop changing, and you put write the number down. But you're measuring a volume of or a mass of liquid as well, which you can't just pour the liquid in there, obviously. You have to put it in the container. Then there's two ways to go about that, which, just to make this simpler, let's all pretend that my wallet here is like a beaker, and let's say the set of keys is the liquid that I want to put in the beaker. So I could come up and zero off the balance, put my beaker in there, write down the mass of the beaker. Then without hitting anything on the balance, I then put my liquid in there and get the combined mass of the liquid and the container. This would be what's known as mass by difference. So if you take the mass of the container and the water and you subtract out the mass of the container, you're going to get the mass of water. There is another way that technically you could do it. You could put your container on there first. Then zero out the balance. The balance will hit whatever zero you tell it to. So you could make the balance do the work of doing the subtraction, where you make the mass with that container equal to zero. And then if you put your liquid or whatever other substance in there, then you would be directly measuring the mass of that liquid. You might think, well, why wouldn't we do it that way? Well, because of exactly the situation we got here. We have a handful of balances. We have two classrooms of students using them. So let's say that you come in here and you put your beaker down and you hit the zero button. And then you pull your beaker out to go get your liquid. And as soon as you get up, someone else sits down and starts using the balance and they hit the zero button again. Which means you've lost that calibration, and if you already put your liquid in, that means you'd have to dry it out, clean it out, in order to be able to do your measurement. So unless you have your own dedicated balance, we usually do the difference, do the measurements by difference instead of directly. And so that's, in fact, the way that you're going to do it today. You're going to get the mass of your graduated cylinder or beaker, and then you're going to get the combined mass of your container with whatever liquid that you put in it. All right? Let's head back on into the classroom.
Sorry, I didn't know we were meeting
here. Oh, come on in.
Okay, thank you.
So now that we've talked about doing volume measurements, we've talked about doing mass measurements, I do need to talk a little bit about significant figures. And if you've had this topic before, this is not going to be the most extensive discussion. But the main point is this, that if you're doing some kind of measurement and then you do some calculations, you're not necessarily going to keep every digit that your calculator gives you. Because how many numbers you keep really depends on the type of instrumentation that you use, the precision of whatever glassware device that you're using. So that's why we need to talk about significant figures. Or as my math instructor used to call them, sig figs. So, to keep the discussion simple, let's say that we always use a decimal point in the numbers that we're using. So you end up with two different situations. If you have a number that starts with a decimal and some zeros, well, those zeros in front of the number aren't really significant digits. They're just placeholders to make the number as small as it's supposed to be. So I call these leading zeros. And in terms of significant figures, those are ignored. So in this example number, 0.00370, that last zero does count. Just like I had said earlier, in a spreadsheet or a calculator, it might drop zeros at the end. But if we write those zeros in, it specifically means that they were directly measured. So anytime you write a zero in, even at the end, it's counted. So in this case, the number has 3 sig figs. So to write out the rule, if a number begins with a decimal, if it begins with a decimal point, every digit after including the first non-zero digit is significant. Now, the other case is if we have a number that starts with something that's not a decimal point. And in that case, the rule is even simpler. Every single digit is a significant figure. So in this case, we would have 5 sig figs. So if a number has a decimal point in the middle, or end, every digit is significant. Now, that's just for figuring out how many sig figs a number has. Then, what do you do if we add and subtract numbers? Well, addition and subtraction are really just opposites of each other. So you do the same thing for addition like you do subtraction. And let me give you an example here. Let's say that we have 10.731, 110.00, and then 5.7467. If we add them all together, we don't worry about sig figs first. We just go ahead and do the addition. So I'm going to get, 7, 7, 7, 4, 6, 1, 1. 126.477. Now, how much of that information in the answer are we going to keep? Well, here's the logic behind it. If we look at the numbers that are being added together, you see one of the numbers goes out more digits than the other. So we look up above, then we don't really know what's being added on those last digits. Because the number 110.00, what comes afterwards? Is the next digit a 1? Is it a 6? Is it a 9? We don't know what it is. That's why it wasn't written in the first place. And so since these numbers out here are unknown, we have to throw out the part of the number. So we draw a dividing line here as soon as any of the numbers run out of digits. Now, on the left-hand side, you might say, well, what about in front? Well, any zeros in front, those are just placeholders. They don't really count as digits. So when you're reading from left to right, wherever you run out of digits in any number, then that digit on is left out. Now, in this case, where we're dividing this number up, since the number past that line is 7, we're going to round up the previous digit. So in other words, this is going to turn into the number 126.48. and we do the normal process of rounding you must have learned before, that if the digit afterwards is 6 or higher, then you're going to round the previous digit up. If the next digit is 5 or below 5, did I just say 6 or higher? 5 or higher, then you're going to round the previous digit up. If it's below 5, so 0 for 4, then you're going to round the previous digit down. You got a question?
So how do significant figures play into the percentage of error?
So percent error would be a separate thing. But let's say that you end up with a percent error that's 2 versus 2.74. So that means you have a more precise result when you've got more digits. So precision and sig figs are separate from a concept of what percent error is. Yes? No, percent error doesn't do directly with standard deviation or with precision. There can be precision in each measurement that you make and each number that you calculate, but that's its own concept. Percent error is a more directly a measurement of accuracy. How close is one measurement to the actual number? How many digits you have in all those numbers, that would be precision. So let me write out something about what we do with addition and subtraction here. What I said earlier is when reading from left to right, when any number runs out of digits, the last digit is the last one kept in the answer. So again, in this example, we have 110.00. Past that point, some of the other numbers run out of digits. So we cut the number off where that last zero is, because that's where we run out of information. And then, as I said, we look at this last digit that we're going to keep. If the next digit after the last one kept is 0 through 4, the number is rounded down. If it is 5 through 9, the number is rounded up. So in addition and subtraction, we line all the decimal points up because that's how we do addition and subtraction. And that's why we keep the number of digits that we keep. For multiplication and division, it's a little different because the way that we do multiplication and division is different. So I've got the example here of 10.74 multiplied by 8.1. So same as what we did before, we're going to do out the calculation. And then worry about sig figs. So in terms of where I'm going to put my decimal point, since I got three digits right of the decimal point here up top, I'm going to put the decimal point, so I have three digits past it in my answer. So now notice that the decimals don't line up in the numbers I'm combining. So we don't look from left to right anymore. What we do is we look at how many significant figures does each of these individual numbers have. So the top number here has 4 sig figs, because it's got a decimal in the middle of the number, which means everything's a real number. This bottom number only has 2 sig figs. So if you're taking a number with 4 sig figs, and all those digits we interact with a number with just 2 sig figs, then that means we're only going to keep 2 sig figs in our answer. And so in this case, our answer turns into 87. Again, because if we try to keep any more digits than that, well, we didn't have that much information in one of the numbers that we're multiplying. So the way to express that is to say whichever number being multiplied or divided has the lowest number of sig figs, that's the number of sig figs kept in the answer. Now, there's one exception. When you're doing an average, like if you're going to be doing this experiment 3 different times, well, the number 3 is an exact number. So it has as many sig figs as you want it to. So when you're doing your average, you don't look at the number 3 and see that it's only got 1 digit in it. The number 3 has an infinite number of digits. It's an exact number. So I mentioned that because when we did this on Tuesday, the other section got a little thrown off by that. So if you're taking 2 measurements that have a certain number of sig figs in it, then you follow this rule. But if you're just doing an average, that number that you divide by, you don't worry about how many sig figs it has. Okay, so what is it that we're going to be doing today? Well, you're going to be measuring some volumes and masses to come up with density. And just as a reminder, density is a property that is mass over volume. So recall that mass and volume are extensive properties. How much you have depends on how much stuff you've got. But this ratio between mass and volume is a constant for a substance, which means it's an intensive property. Doesn't matter how much of the substance you've got, the density is going to be the same. Now, we're going to be measuring mass in grams, volume in milliliters, so our densities are going to come up to be grams per milliliters. Now, let me walk through the procedure to say what you're going to be doing. So in part A, that part is just to explore a little bit about precision. So what you're going to do is you're going to get a graduated cylinder, which the glassware you need is located right up here at the front of the classroom. So you have 10 milliliter graduated cylinders, 100 milliliter graduated cylinders, and beakers that are on the cart over here. You take a 10 milliliter graduated cylinder and fill it with approximately 8 milliliters of water. And when it says approximate, that means yes. If you get 7.5, that's fine. If you get 8.25, that's fine. Just supposed to be around 8. You're supposed to read the volume based off of that graduated cylinder, which for the 10 milliliter graduated cylinder, that means you're going to get 2 sig figs. You could get a volume like 7.2, because that's as fine as a division as you're going to be able to read on that piece of glassware. Now, if the divisions are wider, sometimes we recommend to estimate the next digit beyond that, but they're not going to be wide enough in this case. So you're going to keep 2 sig figs for your answers. You're then supposed to pour that same amount of liquid into a 100 milliliter graduated cylinder. And what you're supposed to notice then is you lose some information. There are not as many markings, and so there you do have to estimate in order to be able to come up with a volume. So you might still keep two sig figs because you will be estimating, but we know then that the information isn't as good as what we get from a 10 milliliter graduated cylinder. After you do that, you pour it into a beaker, which will seem like a little bit of a silly exercise, but again, it's just to emphasize the difference between these types of glassware. The beaker is going to have hardly any markings on it, so you're really only going to be able to get one sig fig out of it. So that's the purpose of part A, is just to physically observe these differences in how you can do measurement. You might even see a difference in the volume you measure, which would reflect the fact that the scales and graduated cylinders are just not as carefully made as on other pieces of glassware. So that's part A. Now part B, you're effectively doing the same procedure twice. So the first part here is where you're supposed to use a known liquid. And what we're going to use is just tap water. If you flip to the next page, you then do the same procedure with an unknown liquid. So again, up at the front of the classroom, we have a couple of trays of chemicals. One of them, the identities are all labeled. We're going to ignore that tub of chemicals. The other one has a set that is color-coded on the top, and those are all unknown samples. So you want to write down which unknown you have, either based off the color of the lid, or I think it also has numbers on the side, or letters on the side to tell you which one it is. So let me talk about what we do with the known liquid first. You're going to get your 10 milliliter graduated cylinder again, and you need to make sure that it's dried out to begin with, because you're supposed to get the mass of that empty graduated cylinder. Then you fill it up with about 5 milliliters of water, that's the known liquid, and then you're going to get the combined mass of the graduated cylinder with the water. You're also supposed to record the volume of the water based off the graduated cylinder. Now, if you're looking along in the book and you flip to the page 15, that's where you write your data down. So in part B there, the identity of the known sample, it's water. The true value, or the accepted density of water at room temperature, which we call 25 degrees Celsius, that's equal to 0.997 grams per milliliter. Looked it up online. So what you do with the 5 milliliter sample, the way the procedure describes it, that all goes in trial one, that column there. Then if you look back at the directions, it says repeat this procedure, the one you just did, drying it out, measuring the mass of the graduated cylinder, adding some liquid, but this time you use 8 milliliters of water. Remember that density is an intensive property, so you should get the same density out. So when you do 8 milliliters, that's what's going to be written here in trial 2. And then you do it one more time with about 10 milliliters of liquid, and that's going to be what's considered trial 3. So then you're going to come up with the densities, and then you're asked to calculate percent range, but ignore that calculation. Just worry about the percent error, which again, we know the value of water, so you'll be able to do that percent error. Now, if you look at the procedure on the top of page 14, it says to essentially do the same thing over again, but this time with the unknown liquid. So you'll dry out and measure the mass of the graduated cylinder. You'll add in the unknown liquid, and you're going to do that with 5 milliliters and then 8 milliliters and then 10 milliliters, again, repeating what you did in the first part. If you look at the data table on page 16, it says to get the number of the unknown sample, so you'll get that off of the label. You'll have the three trials, just like before, where you do 5, 8, and 10 milliliters. You'll get the average density of the liquid, but you're not going to know which liquid you have today. I'm not going to give those values out today. I'll give them next week when we talk about the lab again. So that means for right now, for today, you'll be able to come up with the average density, but you won't be able to come up with a percent error because purposely I'm not giving you that information yet. So that's what we're doing for part B. Now, part C is another measurement of density using a solid instead of a liquid. And we're only going to do the first part of part C, where it says a regular solid. And so I have a set of blocks up here at the front, some of which are labeled with sample numbers, some of them not. Ignore the ones that are missing a number, just go for the ones that do have some number on them. You'll be able to get the mass just by putting it directly on the balance. To get the volume, you're going to do a measurement calculation instead, which if you don't have your own ruler, there are rulers in the lab techs, which I think these are accurate. I think these are done to scale. So you can just use the rulers in your lab techs to measure out these bricks. There are rectangular bricks, there are cylindrical bricks. You choose whichever kind you want to do, and you only need to do one of them, and you only need to do one trial. So if you end up with something that's rectangular, then to get that volume, that would just be, that's right, length times width times height. So you just make the three measurements, multiply them all together. If you choose to do a cylinder instead, then what you can do is measure all the way across, which gives you the diameter. So remember that the radius, R, is equal to the diameter divided by 2. And then the volume we get by getting the area of that circular part, which is pi r squared, and then we multiply it by how tall it is, the height, in order to come up with volume. So that's all of the part C that we're going to do. Because this is such a simple experiment, we won't be doing this in lab partners. You're just going to be doing it individually. And like I said, all the glassware that you're going to need is located up at the front of the classroom. Now, even though the unknown samples, I'll just tell you, are salt water, we're using glassware in today's experiment. So you need to have your safety goggles on because, again, you never know when some kind of glass breakage might occur. And if some really spectacular accident happens, something falls from a good height and you get it shattering everywhere, well, then you never know when something might go flying up at eye level. So even if we're not using truly hazardous chemicals today, you still all need to have goggles on, which if you don't have your goggles yet, you could check them out from the stock room based off of your locker number. In terms of chemical safety, it is just tap water and effectively salt water that we're using. So unlike other experiments we might do, this experiment today, only today, you can dump out your unknown samples into the sink because it's just salt water. So you won't need to dispose of it in any special way. You probably don't need to use gloves at all because it's just salt water as well.